United States chose to withdraw from the battlefield, the war was then lost. The North Vietnamese army overran South Vietnam, and the country was united under communist rule. End footnote. As McMaster points out in his preface to Dereliction of Duty, Harper Perennial, 1998, the war continues to capture the public interest in part because, looking back, its cost seems exorbitant, and would seem so even if the United States had won. The war took the lives of 58,000 Americans and well over 1 million Vietnamese. It left Vietnam in ruins and consumed billions of American dollars, nearly wrecking the American economy. Vietnam divided American society and inflicted on the United States one of the greatest political traumas since the Civil War. 30 years later, after the end of the Cold War, the shadow of the American experience in Vietnam still hangs heavy over American foreign and military policy and over American society. In retrospect, it's axiomatic that consolidating military power in a single superweapon carries its own potential seeds of destruction. Either others will acquire the knowledge and technology to duplicate, nullify, or equalize it, or they will find a way to destroy it because they have no other option. Its very existence tips the balance of power. That is why both Death Stars were doomed. As Sun Tzu, 544 to 496 BCE, wrote in The Art of War, "The art of war teaches us to rely not on the likelihood of the enemy's not coming, but on our own readiness to receive him, not on the chance of his not attacking, rather on the fact that we have made our position unassailable." In the instances of both Death Stars and of Starkiller Base, the rebels found those positions assailable and then attacked, emerging triumphant. The importance of standard operating procedures. I knew the equipment was pretty new. In fact, the guy who was on the scope, who first detected the planes, it was the first time he'd ever sat at the scope, so I figured they were pretty green and not had any opportunity to view a flight of B-17s coming in. Common sense said, well, these are the B-17s. So I told them, don't worry about it. Lieutenant Kermit Tyler, officer on duty at Pearl Harbor. Imagine you are on a search and seizure team to intercept an enemy vessel. As soon as you board, a fast boat speeds away from the ship you've just boarded. Do you let it go? Do you fire warning shots? Or do you destroy it? You've got to make a decision right now. As the senior officer present, what are your orders? For want of a nail. In Star Wars, A New Hope, the Devastator, an Imperial Star Destroyer, captures a rebel ship and commences to board it. The stormtroopers storm through a door, blasting away, engage in a close-quarters firefight, and soon have the crew of the Tantive IV in full rout. They are quickly rounded up as prisoners. On board the Star Destroyer, on a main view screen, we see an escape pod speeding away to the nearby planet Tatooine. A chief pilot observes it and tells his captain, "There goes another one." "Hold your fire," the captain says. "There are no life forms. It must have short-circuited." Given the chain of events, the officer in charge has only two logical choices. One, blow the escape pod to smithereens to prevent it from reaching Tatooine. Two, immediately dispatch a ship in hot pursuit to follow it to Tatooine, recover the escape pod, and recapture its occupants before they can leave the pod. So why didn't the officer do so? He decided that because scans showed there were no human life forms, there must have been a mechanical malfunction, that the pod had been jettisoned by mistake. He chose poorly. As a result, the droids, with a little pluck and a lot of luck, eventually managed to get indispensable information into the hands of the Rebel Alliance, which enabled them to formulate a battle plan to attack, which in turn allowed them to destroy the Death Star. As Benjamin Franklin, among others, observed, "For the want of a nail, the shoe was lost. For the want of a shoe, the horse was lost. For the want of a horse, the rider was lost. For the want of a rider, the battle was lost. For the want of a battle, the kingdom was lost. And all for the want of a horseshoe nail. And so it was in this situation. By not firing at the escape pod and by allowing it to continue on its path, a seemingly small incident morphed into catastrophic loss for the Empire. But if there had been a written standard operating procedure on hand, things might have turned out quite differently for all parties involved. The Empire would have prevailed, and there would have been no need to build a second Death Star. SOP, Standard Operating Procedure. ATP-3-90.90, Army Tactical Standard Operating Procedures, November 2011, explains, "A standard operational procedure is a set of instructions covering those features of operations which lend themselves to a definitive or standardized procedure without loss of effectiveness. A SOP is both standing and standard. It instructs how to perform a prescribed and accepted process established for completing a task. Features of operations that lend themselves to standardization are common and usually detailed processes performed often and requiring minimal variation each time. Well-written and properly used unit tactical SOPs enhance effective execution of tasks. The benefits of SOPs are numerous. They reduce training time, the loss of unwritten information, the commission of errors, the omission of essential steps or processes, and the time required for completion of tasks. The question arises, does the Empire use SOPs at all? If so, the SOP for boarding party procedures should have spelled out, 1. No vessels are allowed to leave the captured ship. 2. All signals and on all frequencies from any escaping vessel must be jammed to prevent all transmission of data. 3. All vessels must be destroyed immediately. 4. In the event a vessel reaches safety, its timely recovery is essential. A recovery team on standby alert will immediately pursue the vessel, recover it, and return it to the ship to determine what sensitive information or materials, if any, it contained. 5. In the event recovery is not possible, after its computer banks are scanned, the data is downloaded, and all sensitive documents are secured, the vessel must be destroyed in place using any available means. In this instance, a recovery effort did ensue, but it was too little and too late. With the passage of time, the escape pod lived up to its namesake. It had landed on Tatooine, while Darth Vader was otherwise occupied on board Tantive IV, allowing both droids to go on their merry way. If Empire staff officers had drafted a tactical SOP, the landing party on board the Devastator would have known exactly what to do. They would have secured the ship. Nobody else gets on, and nobody gets off. There would be no escape for the princess at this or any other time, nor for anyone else, including the droids you were supposed to be looking for. Standing Orders, Rogers Rangers, by Major Robert Rogers, 1759. These orders, adopted by Army Rangers, appear at the end of Ranger Handbook, July 1992, with a prefatory note. Even though they are over 200 years old, they apply just as well to Ranger operations conducted on today's battlefield as they did to the operations conducted by Rogers and his men. Based on Rogers' 28 Rules of Ranging, formulated in July 1767, a truncated colloquial version was published in 1937 by Kenneth Roberts in his novel Northwest Passage. 1. Don't forget nothing. 2. Have your musket clean as a whistle, hatchet scoured, 60 rounds powder and ball, and be ready to march at a minute's warning. 3. When you're on the march, act the way you would if you was sneaking up on a deer. See the enemy first. 4. Tell the truth about what you see and what you do. There is an army depending on us for correct information. You can lie all you please when you tell other folks about the Rangers, but don't ever lie to a Ranger or officer. 5. Don't never take a chance you don't have to. 6. When we're on the march, we march single file, far enough apart so no one shot can go through two men. 7. If we strike swamps or soft ground, we spread out abreast so it's hard to track us. 8. When we march, we keep moving till dark so as to give the enemy the least possible chance at us. 9. When we camp, half the party stays awake while the other half sleeps. 10. If we take prisoners, we keep them separate till we have had time to examine them, so they can't cook up a story between them. 11. Don't ever march home the same way. Take a different route so you won't be ambushed. 12. No matter whether we travel in big parties or little ones, each party has to keep a scout 20 yards ahead and 20 yards on each flank and 20 yards in the rear, so the main body can't be surprised and wiped out. 13. Every night you'll be told where to meet if surrounded by a superior force. 14. Don't sit down to eat without posting sentries. 15. Don't sleep beyond dawn. Dawn's when the French and Indians attack. 16. Don't cross a river by a regular ford. 17. If somebody's trailing you, make a circle. Come back onto your own tracks and ambush the folks that aim to ambush you. 18. Don't stand up when the enemy's coming against you. Kneel down. Hide behind a tree. 19. Let the enemy come till he's almost close enough to touch. Then let him have it, and jump out and finish him up with your hatchet. Editor's note. This may be the first instance of an SOP in the U.S. military. Part 5. Lessons Learned from Key Battles. Human nature will not change. In any future great national trial, compared with the men of this, we shall have as weak and as strong, as silly and as wise, as bad and good. Let us, therefore, study the incidents of this as philosophy to learn wisdom from, and none of them as wrongs to be revenged. Abraham Lincoln on the 1864 election. The operational arts, the use of military forces to achieve strategic goals through the design, organization, integration, and conduct of strategies, campaigns, major operations, and battles, takes a long time to master. As anyone in the military will tell you, the learning never stops. At every rank I held, from an ROTC cadet in high school, then ROTC in college, and then from second lieutenant to major, the more I learned, the more I realized how much more there was to learn. As a student at Command and General Staff College, I was reminded of that when I was studying battle analysis. The school gives its students a template that is used to write a detailed analysis, which includes tactical, strategic, and operational considerations. The purpose of the analysis is not merely to summarize what happened, but, as the school tells us, to assess the significance of the action. This is the most important step of the battle analysis process. With this step, you are turning combat information in the form of the historical facts of the battle into finished analysis rendered as lessons learned. That's the bottom line. What can be gleaned is to be shared with future leaders so that the same mistakes aren't repeated and we become better in the operational arts. All the major battles that we've seen on screen in the Star Wars universe provide considerable food for thought for their fans, for students of military history, and for military professionals. My focus is to discuss what has largely not been discussed in the official books, lessons learned from military engagements, which is best written from the viewpoint of someone in the combat arms who knows the territory. For that reason, I am leaving the summaries and detailed information about equipment and personnel to those writing the officially licensed books. Because those pop culture writers are civilians, their perspective is, understandably, different from mine. With that in mind, I'll briefly cover the ground battle of Naboo, the Phantom Menace, the Battle of Yavin, A New Hope, the ground battle of Hoth, The Empire Strikes Back, the Battle of Endor, Return of the Jedi, and a skirmish on Jeddah, Rogue One. At the end of this section, I'll read the text of the Command and General Staff College Student Handout, its study guide for battle analysis. As you'll hear, the study guide is comprehensive, specific, and is suggested as a template for any military professional seeking insight from historical battles and campaigns to help deepen his or her understanding of warfare and the profession of arms. Although the template is most useful for military professionals, those who have served, especially in leadership positions, it is an excellent tool for non-military personnel to clarify and focus their military thinking. If nothing else, the discussions that follow should provide ample food for thought. Because there is no one right answer for every situation, because the nature of combat is in a state of constant flux, there's plenty of room for discussion. The Ground Battle of Naboo. Reference: Star Wars I, The Phantom Menace. As Roman general Publius Renatus wrote in Epitoma Re Militaris, "If you want peace, prepare for war. Put differently, the best defense is a strong offense." When I think about the wisdom of those words, it recalls the ground battle at Naboo in Star Wars II, Attack of the Clones. In that force-on-force battle, the Gungan army could only have won by default because they had never prepared, that is, trained, for war. In official Star Wars reference books, we glean two critical facts. The Gungan army is wholly composed of citizen soldiers, and their equipment is inadequate against a technologically superior force. We have to admire the Gungans for their courage, but when facing a well-equipped, better-trained fighting force, the Gungans have little recourse but to put up the best fight they can and then retreat, while hoping to minimize casualties. The Gungans' fighting spirit recalls that of the Imperial Japanese Army, which marched into battle buoyed by its celebrated fighting spirit. This is admirable as far as that goes, but not militarily effective, as Japanese historian Saburo Ienaga, The Pacific War, pointed out. A striking feature of the doctrine is its excessive emphasis on spirit. The literature is full of phrases about the attack spirit, confidence in certain victory, and sacrifice one's life to the country, absolute obedience to superiors. Even brave NCOs, highly motivated by spiritual training, saw that the Imperial Army's strategic doctrine was outdated and stupid. There is no question that fighting spirit is important in combat, but that kind of magical thinking isn't enough to win battles. What does win battles? A combined arms operation in which overwhelming, decisive firepower is brought to bear against the enemy. This is why the Imperial Japanese Army found itself at a significant disadvantage against the Americans, especially in the last year of the war, when munitions were in short supply, their logistics tail was cut off, and flagging morale took a toll. They could see their inevitable fate. Catastrophic losses of men and materiel in combat with inevitable and unconditional surrender. In addition to being inadequately trained in the operational arts of fire and maneuver, the Gungan army went into battle with inadequate resources. Only one defensive weapon and one offensive weapon. In other words, the Gungans up against a droid army were like the Native American population armed with bows and arrows against the American military armed with rifles. From all appearances, the Gungans didn't properly plan a retrograde operation, though that was their only option. It was a tactical decision that nearly cost them the loss of their entire fighting force. The U.S. Army's Field Manual 7-20, the Infantry Battalion, states the purpose of a retrograde operation. A retrograde operation can be used to avoid decisive combat under unfavorable conditions, to maintain freedom of maneuver, or to save forces for decisive action elsewhere. The underlying reason for conducting a retrograde operation is to improve a tactical situation or to prevent a worse one from occurring. A battalion conducts a retrograde as part of a larger force to harass, exhaust, resist, and delay the enemy. To gain time. To reposition or preserve forces. To use a force elsewhere. To draw the enemy into an unfavorable position. To shorten lines of communication and supply. To clear zones for friendly use of chemical or nuclear weapons. To conform to the movement of other friendly forces. In short, it's a defensive operation. The goal is not to try to engage and destroy the enemy, but instead to disengage tactically, to preserve your troop strength, to minimize casualties, by buying time. The tactical blunder on the part of the Gungans, though, is that they relied too heavily on a single piece of defensive equipment to protect them, and when that weapon became inoperative, the Gungans had no contingency plan. The issue of combat strength and firepower is critical in this discussion because the Gungan army was simply undermanned, whereas the Empire's droids were numerous. Likewise, firepower. The Gungans' weapons, individual, crew-served, and very loosely defined artillery, were effective only when direct hits were possible. But the Empire's superior weapons, when appearing on the battlefield, were enough to cause the shocked Gungans to stare in disbelief and palpable fear. The droids had high-powered blasters, backed up by rolling battle droids and tanks. In essence, Gungans showed up with knives to a gunfight. Lessons learned. Gungan defense. The Gungans had the home field advantage, but completely failed to use it. If I had been an operations officer at battalion or brigade level on the Gungan side, here are some of my recommendations based solely on what we see in Attack of the Clones. 1. Dig foxholes. This would have provided some cover against small arms fire, crew-served weapons, and tanks. Because the Empire showed up at the field of battle with direct fire, line-of-sight weapons, the Gungans would have benefited from reducing their physical profile by having hardened foxholes. 2. Lay a minefield on all probable avenues of approach. This has two benefits. It forces the enemy to explore other avenues of approach, which can also be booby-trapped, or it may channel the enemy into a designated kill zone. It also denies the enemy key terrain. 3. Protect offensive capability assets. The Gungans use medieval-style catapults to launch disruptor-style energy balls, but these were employed in the open. Instead, position them as far back as possible and properly shelter them against tank fire. 4. Well before going into the battle, plan on executing a by-the-book retrograde operation. The main battle force should buy time and fall back by echelon, protected by Gungans on the flanks. This ensures an orderly movement to the rear as opposed to what in fact happened, an unprotected full rout as panic set in. 5. Make better use of defensive shields by studying the tactics of the Roman legions, who employed them in varying formations to minimize attrition of their ranks. This would have protected the Gungans against the individual weapons fire from the droids and perhaps from the twin-armed droidekas, rolling droids. 6. Recruit and train a standing army ready for immediate deployment. 7. Acquire technologically sophisticated individual and crew-served weapons, borrowing them from the Naboo if necessary, which would give them a fighting chance. Armed only with hand-thrown or catapult-launched disruptive energy balls, Gungans aren't equipped to fight on a modern battlefield. 8. Train combat engineers for mining, breaching, and other operations. 9. Use electronic radio communications instead of vocal commands and hand signals. 10. Take advantage of the natural terrain for cover and concealment. 11. Design a handheld weapon for close-in fighting, because many force-on-force battles end up in close-quarters fighting. 12. keep at least a third of the forces in reserve. Don't commit all your forces at once, because some will be needed for covering fire when retreating tactically. 13. Establish a proper military liaison with the Naboo to share weapons technology and battlefield information, and train in peacetime with live fire exercises in war games to gauge combat skills. Lessons learned, Galactic Empire. Without question, the Empire's biggest blunder is that the leadership failed to recognize the need for redundant power systems that would have prevented their standing army from literally collapsing on the field of battle. But, in terms of military strategy, their battle plan also was seriously flawed. Where were the air assets? The use of close air support in this battle should have been a no-brainer, especially since the Gungans would have been defenseless. Where was the artillery? The Gungans had no counter-battery fire assets, so the Empire was free to shell the Gungans at will. Knowing the Gungans' defensive shield could easily be penetrated by simply walking through it, backed up by rolling droids, droidekas, why didn't they do that first? That way the Gungan shield would have come down a lot sooner, and then the droid army could lay down a withering fire with direct fire and indirect fire supplemented with close air support. We can chalk up these and other battlefield considerations to the Empire's overconfidence. It may be why the commander's operations staff never drew up an order of battle to identify the Gungans' strengths and weaknesses. The Empire simply felt it was bigger, better, and couldn't lose against the militarily primitive Gungans, so why bother studying the military situation? Because, as the droid army discovered, in combat, you cannot take anything for granted. The Battle of Yavin. Reference, Star Wars 4, A New Hope. The tactical situation as seen from the Empire's point of view. Its superweapon is under attack by a small rebel force. Death Star 1. With a franchise as large as Star Wars, which spans 40 years, the issue of continuity is critical. Researching information about the first Death Star's specifics, its size, defensive and offensive capabilities, and manning, reveals numerous inconsistencies among various official sources. So, I'll dispense with a detailed examination of the offensive and defensive capabilities of the weapons system itself, and instead focus on the big picture, the tactical considerations, in a very general way. When we first see the Death Star on the big screen, we feel a sense of awe and then increasing dread, just as the good guys do when they get their first look at it. Even at a distance, it looks to be the size of a small moon. We can infer that its manning, the combat troops and infrastructure to support them and the Death Star itself, is commensurate. To give a sense of scale, U.S. Army units are thus configured, from smallest to largest. Section, squad, platoon or troop, company, battalion, regiment, brigade, division, corps, and army. Approximately 100,000 personnel. As noted earlier, the complete Star Wars Encyclopedia notes that the first Death Star has an operational crew of 265,000, and additional personnel that brings the total manning to over 1,000,000. Footnote, perhaps because of the sprawling nature of the Star Wars universe, it's difficult to ensure uniformity in the printed and online media. According to the fan-based Wookiepedia, accessed September 23, 2017, the first Death Star had 342,953 members of the Imperial Army and Navy, 25,984 stormtroopers, and nearly 2,000,000 personnel of varying combat eligibility. End footnote. In other words, the Death Star represents a significant portion of the Empire's military manpower, which is not easily replaced. The number of skilled personnel to run, service, and operate such a weapons platform represents a significant investment of time necessary to train all the military personnel. Their collective loss would take years to reconstitute across the board. The cost to construct the Death Star and the time necessary to build it are, for purposes of my discussion, secondary concerns. My primary concern is the military strategy employed by the Empire against its nemesis, the Rebel Air Force. A superweapon. By definition, the Death Star is a superweapon, a weapon specifically designed to be a game-changer. In other words, it's an irresistible force whose mere presence creates an immediate threat and, logically, would result in the immediate capitulation of the enemy. The Death Star recalls Sun Tzu's observation in The Art of War that supreme excellence consists in breaking the enemy's resistance without fighting. To put things in perspective, imagine you are a planetary ruler in charge of defense, and the enemy has created a weapon so devastating that you're told resistance is futile. Are you willing to take the enemy's word at face value and assume that the weapon is as powerful as it's made out to be? Or are you going to wait for a demonstration at the cost of many lives and massive destruction of property? Or will you simply discount it altogether as a bluff or hyperbole? The Japanese emperor, the members of his court, and the Imperial Army and Navy had to ponder that very question in 1945 when faced with the prospect of a new and most terrible weapon, the atomic bomb. The Manhattan Project. On July 16, 1945, in Alamogordo, New Mexico, the world's first atomic bomb was successfully detonated. It ushered in the atomic age, casting a long shadow. Footnote: 72 years later, it continues to resonate as we contemplate the implications of a nuclear-capable North Korea, a rogue nation that claims to have developed a hydrogen bomb. End footnote. Faced with the prospect of ending the war with Japan through invasion, planners hoped that the development of a superweapon, an atomic bomb, could bring a quick and decisive end to the war, minimizing loss of life on both sides. The alternative would be an invasion, which would take an even greater human toll. In the end, President Truman made a decision to employ the newly developed nuclear weapon against Japan. The first was dropped on Hiroshima, August 6, 1945. The second on Nagasaki, August 9th. 6 days later, the Japanese Empire surrendered. Emperor Hirohito, in a countrywide radio broadcast, told his subjects that the enemy has begun to employ a new and most cruel bomb, the power of which to do damage is indeed incalculable, taking the toll of many innocent lives. Should we continue to fight, not only would it result in an ultimate collapse and obliteration of the Japanese nation, but also it would lead to the total extinction of human civilization. In other words, the deployment of what he termed a most cruel bomb put a quick end to a long and bloody war that had dragged on for 4 long years. Given time, the American firebombing campaign using B-29 bombers would likely have accomplished the goal, but time was of the essence. The United States did consider a show of atomic force by detonating a bomb offshore and allowing the Japanese to witness its destructive power, but the powers that be ultimately decided to employ it directly against the enemy nation. It'd show that the Allies were serious. The first bomb got Japan's attention. The second was the knockout punch that prompted Japan to accept the terms of the Potsdam Agreement, formulated by 3 major world powers, the United States, Great Britain, and Russia. The Death Star as a superweapon. In A New Hope, Grand Moff Tarkin, commanding the Death Star, opts to destroy a planet populated with billions of people. For purposes of such a demonstration, an uninhabitable planet would have been plenty of proof, but annihilating a populated planet in one attack sends a clear message to everyone else in the galaxy: surrender or die. With such a superweapon at its disposal, the Empire's leadership could dictate to all the worlds the unconditional terms of surrender. In such a case, a bad choice is preferable to no choice at all. All of this speaks to why the ragtag rebel force was forced to go up against the Death Star. It was a David and Goliath encounter, and the only hope for free people throughout the galaxy. The Empire had the Force, but the Force was ultimately with the Rebel Alliance. As the leadership on the Death Star well knew, their orbiting weapon would, sooner or later, come under attack because it was a highly prized military asset, so its designers planned for it. Defensively, the Death Star bristled with turbo lasers and tractor beams. Offensively, it could deploy several cruisers and many thousands of TIE fighters. Given the devastating power of the main turbo laser, supplemented with a full array of defensive and offensive weapons, how was the seemingly impossible accomplished? At this very late date, 4 decades after A New Hope, no spoiler alert is necessary. Everyone knows that the first Death Star was destroyed by the Rebel forces. In fact, it's the germinal plot of Rogue One, A Star Wars Story, 2016. But in the wake of the Death Star's complete destruction, we must put ourselves in the situation of the Empire's leadership and military planners and look back at what happened with the hope of preventing it from recurring, especially since a second Death Star was either under consideration or scheduled for construction. The principal consideration is that a weapons platform like the Death Star is too valuable to lose. Therefore, it must be protected at all costs. With that firmly in mind, there's much that the ranking officers, especially the admiral in command of the Death Star, might have done to prevent its destruction. 1. Assess vulnerabilities. Before the Death Star was fielded, the command staff should have studied the weapons platform in detail to determine any flaws. See A New Hope, in which that vulnerability is exploited. Infantrymen know that when occupying terrain, they must study the terrain and provide interlocking fields of fire for individual and crew-served weapons. The lack of this on the Death Star allowed the enemy to traverse airspace that otherwise would have been denied. 2. Determine enemy capabilities. To properly plan for defensive and offensive operations, it is critical to know the enemy's capabilities. In this case, what military assets did the Rebel Alliance have? How many fighter aircraft, of what kind, and armed with what kind of munitions? Order of battle intelligence is a crucial component of the Empire's war planning. During the course of the battle itself, the operations staff on board the Death Star correctly determined the fighter aircraft's target and inferred the method of engagement, but by that time it was too late. In Field Manual 30-19, Department of the Army, June 1959, Order of Battle Intelligence, we learn that it refers to the manner in which military forces are organized, disposed, maneuvered, and supplied. Order of Battle Intelligence consists of accepted data regarding the composition, disposition, strength, training, tactics, logistics, combat efficiency, and miscellaneous data applicable to an enemy military force. Order of Battle Intelligence is mandatory for commanders and staffs at all echelons in the preparation of accurate estimates of the situation and effective plans of action. It is an integral part of combat intelligence. It must be considered, together with other intelligence pertaining to the enemy, to the terrain, and to the weather, in determining enemy capabilities and probable courses of action. In the Battle of Yavin, nothing suggests that the Empire had conducted such a study, because the Empire did not implement a battle plan in a proactive manner, either defensively or offensively. 3. Take out command and control. Because fighter aircraft leave from and return to a home base, whether a mobile platform like an aircraft carrier or a geographically fixed location such as an airbase, its destruction is paramount. The Empire failed to target the remote Rebel Alliance base prior to the Alliance deployment of a fighter wing, fighters, and bombers. Had it done so, it would have destroyed CNC and significantly handicapped the rebel fighters long before the air battle was engaged. We see the advantage of preemptive strikes. When the Japanese attacked Pearl Harbor in 1941, they wisely planned on bombing and strafing U.S. fighter planes on the ground to prevent them from engaging in the air battle. Even though a few U.S. planes took to the air, most of them, conveniently co-located, were methodically destroyed in place. Destroying the remote weapons platform or airbase and its assets accomplishes several objectives. First, air combat, which is obviously a chaotic environment, becomes even more so when the ground-based headquarters cannot monitor the battle and provide guidance or further assistance. In essence, the pilots are on their own. Second, it denies the pilots a safe home port after the battle. And finally, it denies air reinforcements and degrades the ability of the fighting force to reconstitute and initiate a subsequent second-wave attack. Deploy as a battle group. By far, the Empire's biggest mistake was to deploy the Death Star, a major weapon system, by itself. Instead, it should have gone into battle as the nucleus of a battle group, like a modern U.S. nuclear-powered aircraft carrier. Looking at the construction, cost, manning, and operational life of an aircraft carrier enables us to understand why the loss of a Death Star is, in every way, catastrophic. The U.S. Navy's newest aircraft carrier is the USS Gerald R. Ford, built by Newport News Shipbuilding in Newport News, Virginia. This is, in fact, our sole source for flat tops. Disregarding the research and development cost, the unit cost of the aircraft carrier itself is approximately $13 billion. It takes 10 years to build a modern carrier, which is a floating city populated by 2,600 military personnel. With scheduled upgrades in the future, the carrier is expected to have an operational life of 90 years. In other words, it's expensive, and it's a long-term investment. Used for power projection, a carrier's presence anywhere in the world reassures allies and strikes fear in our enemies. The aircraft carrier can launch 40 fighter aircraft supplemented by support aircraft. It has Aegis missiles capable of intercepting and knocking out the enemy's short-range ballistic missiles. The carrier is capable of defending itself, but it is further protected by a ring of complementary warships and a nuclear-powered submarine. The U.S. Navy currently has 10 flat tops, each representing a significant investment of time, money, and most valuable of all, manpower. As retired Navy Captain Jerry Hendricks told Newsweek, February 16, 2016, "The loss of an aircraft carrier with images of 1,000 American dead, or just having it disabled, with all its airplanes and radars knocked out and huge gaping holes in it, is such a heavy political blow that we probably wouldn't risk it unless it was for the actual defense of the continental United States. So, we've created an asset that we cannot afford to lose because it's such an iconic symbol of American power that to have that symbol damaged or destroyed would undermine the legitimacy of America's role in the world. It's the calculus that no one in uniform will talk to you about." It's certainly too awful to contemplate, which is why the aircraft carrier does not steam into battle by itself. To do so would make it unnecessarily vulnerable, even with its sophisticated defensive array and radar and weaponry. Of course, defending it becomes complicated because it must be defensible against attack by all comers, whether by air, land, or sea, both on and below the waterline. Moreover, its defense must be projected as far out as possible to keep the enemy at bay. You don't want the enemy to get close to the aircraft carrier under any circumstances. As Lauren B. Thompson pointed out in National Interest, August 11, 2016, "Putting 5,000 sailors and 6 dozen high-performance aircraft on a $10 billion warship creates what military experts refer to as a very lucrative target. Taking one out would be a big achievement for America's enemies and a big setback for America's military. The U.S. Navy, therefore, sends out its carriers well-protected, cocooned by an accompanying battle group configured as necessary for the mission. The group may include, among other things, a missile cruiser, two guided missile destroyers, an attack submarine, and a supply ship. Just as the U.S. Navy's aircraft carriers sally forth into combat with plenty of protection, the first Death Star should have been similarly protected, but it was not. The equivalent of a U.S. Navy destroyer in the Star Wars universe is a wedge-shaped Star Destroyer. When the Death Star was deployed, it should have been accompanied by a fleet of Star Destroyers positioned to give it a 360-degree protection from enemy vessels. Supplemented by the turbo lasers on the Death Star, the Star Destroyers would prevent any large-scale attack. Moreover, the short-range TIE fighters, when deployed, could dogfight small enemy aircraft, notably the X-Wing and Y-Wing starfighters. But because those assets weren't deployed in full force, the Death Star was essentially unprotected during the Battle of Yavin. In fact, had it not been for Darth Vader deciding to lead a 3-ship formation of TIE fighters to dogfight the Rebels' starfighters, there would have been no Empire fighter aircraft deployed during the battle to attack the Rebel fighters and bombers making their trench runs. Instead of taking the battle to the starfighters, engaging them offensively, the Empire chose to fight a defensive battle. Defense in depth. The Death Star should have been protected with concentric rings of defense to keep the enemy from getting close. It should enjoy air superiority in any battle and be able to attrite enemy aircraft, beginning at the farthest point of engagement, so that even if the Rebels get within striking range, their numbers are reduced to a handful. The outermost ring, number 4, should be defensive in nature, an early warning system to identify the number and composition of enemy aircraft and alert the command. This will determine the Empire's method of engagement: Star Destroyers, TIE Fighters, or a combination of both. The next ring, number 3, inside number 4, should be Star Destroyers. The next ring, number 2, should be turbo lasers, though these should be better designed for firing upon small and large enemy ships alike. The final ring, number 1, should be TIE Fighters for dogfighting. Such an arrangement would have maximized the Death Star's chances of survival in any engagement. After all, no price can be too high to protect the Death Star. Even if a large number of its air assets were destroyed in the process, it would be justified in the end by the survival of the battle station, the loss of which would be equivalent to the loss of not just one U.S. Navy aircraft carrier, but in fact, the loss of the entire U.S. fleet of 10 carriers, an unimaginable and, over time, an unsustainable loss. In short, there's no way the Empire should lose an air battle, given its deployable assets. Wargaming. Short of combat itself, the best way to train for war is to wargame. The working philosophy is simply stated: train as you fight. The idea is to play war as realistically as possible in a field environment with calibrated safety constraints. Wargaming is the training tool that keeps the edge of the blade sharp. All the military services engage in wargaming at every level. It's a learning experience, and its benefits are that it will enhance combat efficiency and effectiveness and ultimately reduce casualties in combat. When I was a newly minted second lieutenant stationed at Fort Riley, Kansas, the home of the 1st Infantry Division, we often had division-wide exercises that brought into play all of our combat assets. The combined arms exercise, which included air support from Air Force bases, gave us a taste of what to expect when the bullets began to fly. We all learned a lot about what worked and what didn't in terms of field operations, and we were reminded how easy it is for things to go wrong in the fog of war. We had to keep our combat edge sharp, because half of our unit was then permanently stationed in Germany, in case the Russian Bear decided to lumber across the Fulda Gap, a real concern during the Cold War. Today, the U.S. Army trains brigade-sized units at Fort Irwin, at its National Training Center set in desert terrain. The resident bad guys have home field advantage and know every nook and cranny of the terrain. Visiting units, of course, have no such advantage. But the resultant force-on-force engagement will teach commanders on both sides and at every level a lot about what went right, what went wrong, and what lessons learned can be applied to future operations. The takeaway. Similarly, when I was a ground liaison officer attached to an Air Force fighter wing of F-16s, one planned mission included flying the entire wing halfway across the country, refueling with air tankers, and dogfighting F-15s over Washington State. The actual time in the cockpit would have been 8 hours, but how else can pilots hone their combat flying skills? As any pilot will tell you, time spent in the cockpit is time well spent, and they can never get enough of it. During World War II, for instance, when fuel was at a premium, the Imperial Japanese Navy cut flight time for new pilots to a bare minimum, because they were hoarding fuel for the expected U.S. land invasion. As a result, U.S. pilots, with better training and more time in the cockpit, easily shot down the novice pilots. All of which brings us to the Empire and the Death Star. We don't know what, if any, wargaming the Empire scheduled for those deployed on the Death Star itself, but the lack of training, in combination with poor leadership at the highest levels, doomed the terror weapon. Wargaming is the time to test battle plans, to play out different scenarios, to see what works best, what's not working, and what to correct for future operations. Lessons learned can then be incorporated into future battle strategies. The starfighter's attack on the Death Star recalls the Japanese attack on Pearl Harbor, which was a scenario Americans had never envisioned. As a result, the United States was caught completely by surprise, with extensive damage to the berthed Pacific Fleet and significant loss of life. The root cause of the destruction of the Death Star was not the flight skills of the X-Wing fighters or their fighting spirit, but the lack of planning at the highest levels. The Death Star's operations staff had failed to properly study the enemy capabilities and therefore underestimated its opponent. Moreover, the staff failed to anticipate possible enemy actions. The cumulative end result was that the Death Star, ironically, lived up to its name. The Ground Battle of Hoth. Reference, Star Wars 5, The Empire Strikes Back. What is the mission? In any military engagement, that is the key question. In the Ground Battle of Hoth, there were two missions for the Empire. The Imperial Army was tasked with destroying two critical pieces of equipment, a force field generator and an ion cannon, while the Imperial Navy was tasked with preventing rebel spaceships from escaping the planet. The former was successfully completed, albeit in an inefficient manner. The latter was an unmitigated disaster. After studying the battle, though, what struck me most was the poor use of combined arms, which bears discussion. As defined by the U.S. Army, combined arms are the appropriate combinations of infantry, mobile protected firepower, offensive and defensive fires, engineers, army aviation, and joint capabilities. It is the application of these combinations in unified action that allows us to defeat enemy ground forces, to seize, occupy, and defend land areas, and to achieve physical, temporal, and psychological advantages over the enemy. By synchronizing combined arms and applying them simultaneously, commanders can achieve a greater effect than if each element was used separately or sequentially. Footnote: Maneuver Self-Study Program, Combined Arms Operations, Benning.Army.Mil. End footnote. Frankly, the Empire's missions were textbook and not difficult. Let's look at them separately. The Rebel Alliance's ground troops were positioned in trenches, supplemented by dismounted infantry and supported by low-level aircraft. Heavy weapons supplemented their small arms fire capability. The goal was to fight a delaying action to buy time for an evacuation of personnel and fighter aircraft. The Empire, in its ground attack, relied on slow-moving, large, all-terrain armored transports. On the face of it, because the Empire successfully overwhelmed the Rebel Alliance ground troops, it would seem that they won the battle, and thus any further discussion is moot. However effective, the plan was not efficient, resulting in the needless loss of equipment and troops. In my opinion, the operations staff on the Death Star erred by planning a ground assault when, in fact, they knew the Rebel Alliance could only fight a delaying action. In terms of accomplishing the mission, knocking out a power generator and a cannon, the Empire's optimum tactic would have been to bypass the ground troops completely and destroy the fixed targets with organic air assets, TIE fighters, while simultaneously landing a large force to take control of the Rebel base. Instead of an air attack, the Empire deployed slow-moving ponderous AT-ATs and dismounted troops to engage the Rebel ground forces, which was not necessary to the Empire's accomplishment of the ground mission. That error was compounded by not providing close air support. The AT-ATs were deployed unprotected, when they needed TIE fighters for air cover, with the result that 2 of 5 AT-ATs were destroyed by Rebel aircraft. Ultimately, the Empire's mission took too long to execute and suffered needless casualties and the loss of major weapons systems. As a result, the Imperial Army handicapped the Imperial Navy's mission because it was unable to stop Rebel ships from escaping the planet to safety. Like the Imperial Army, the Imperial Navy was also at fault. It had a simple task: to implement a standard blockade to prevent Rebel ships from leaving the planet. But the Imperial Navy failed to use its Star Destroyers and TIE Fighters in an effective manner. The destroyers did not contain the fleeing ships, nor were they channeled into a kill zone. Moreover, there were an insufficient number of TIE Fighters deployed to engage the Rebel Alliance Starfighters. Consequently, the Rebel Alliance was able to reconstitute after the battle for a subsequent battle, the air attack on the second Death Star. The battles of Yavin and at Hoth were instrumental in allowing the Rebel Alliance to muster all of its air power for a subsequent battle that decisively put an effective end to the Galactic Empire. To win the war, one must first win its battles. The small Rebel Alliance was vastly outnumbered and outgunned by the Empire, but in the end, size mattered not. The Alliance prevailed militarily because the Empire failed to plan and thus planned to fail. Note, in Star Wars The Last Jedi, 2017, TIE fighters were gainfully employed as close air support, attriting the resistance in their aged fighters. The Battle of Endor. Reference, Star Wars 6, Return of the Jedi. Bigger is better. At least, that was the thinking behind the second Death Star, with construction that began soon after the first one was destroyed. Bigger in every way, more weapons and more fighter aircraft, the operational but partially built second Death Star was a calculated risk. Though the Empire quickly recovered from the destruction of the first Death Star, the second iteration of the battle station required significantly more investments of time, money, and effort. In my opinion, the building of a second Death Star was a strategic mistake that doomed the Empire. Let's look at the reasons why. 1. Even after the first Death Star was destroyed, the Empire decided to go all in and build a second one. Though it's an even more powerful superweapon than its predecessor, the second Death Star suffered from the same fatal flaw as the first one, because it was needlessly vulnerable. 2. The time, money, and energy spent in constructing, manning, and outfitting the second Death Star would have been better spent in dispersing the Empire's assets throughout the galaxy on various planets to minimize their vulnerability. Effective command and control would have linked all the remote bases in a single unbreakable chain. 3. co-locating the top leadership of the Galactic Empire, the Emperor and his second-in-command Darth Vader, in one place near the Death Star meant that once they died, the Empire was leaderless. The failure of the Emperor to establish a chain of command beyond himself and Vader was a major blunder. 4. Compounding the loss of its top leadership, the loss of men, material, and equipment was a significant blow to the Empire's resources that it couldn't afford, especially after the loss of its first Death Star. 5. Reconstitution was impossible. The loss of all hands on the second Death Star and the loss of the Empire's key leadership resulted in organizational chaos. The resulting confusion, complicated by infighting, allowed the Rebel Alliance to take advantage of the situation and emerge victorious as various factions within the Empire fought and failed to seize control. Summary. Had the Empire conserved its resources and dispersed its forces to become less vulnerable to attack from the Rebel Alliance, it could have methodically and systematically attacked the Rebels in preemptive strikes throughout the galaxy, using a fleet of Star Destroyers until the Alliance ceased to be a militarily viable force. But even if the Empire had not dispersed its assets, firmly establishing a chain of command that extended below the Emperor and Darth Vader would have facilitated the reconstitution of the remaining military assets, which was still large enough in